Thanks, Brother Jamie, and good evening, brothers and sisters and young people. Well, first of all, I'd like to make an apology for last week. I know I somewhat drowned you in information, and my endeavour will be to not do that again, to go a little bit more slowly and maybe at a higher level than what we did last week. You may recall that we considered last class how chapters 2, 7 and 8 all have the same terminating point. The time of Christ's return when the kingdom of men will come to an end. And it's heartwarming, brothers and sisters and young people, to read in verse 19 that that time of the end is a certain point in time. Verse 19, and he said, "Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be." So there's a certain time, brothers and sisters, it's locked. God has determined that time when Christ shall come and the kingdoms of men shall end. And what I'd like us to do, just for a moment, to take a step back and to think just how close are we to that end time from what we can gauge in the prophecies of Daniel. Let's just quickly go back to chapter 2. I just want us to think, brothers and sisters, how privileged we are to be able to stand where we are at this point in time with respect to these prophecies. Where are we in terms of the prophecy of Daniel chapter 2? Well, we're in verse 45. Verse 44. In the days of these kings. That's the very time that we're living in. All of what's preceded, the preceding 43 verses, is in the past, it's history. We're in verse 44 of this chapter. Think about this, come to chapter 7 now, and think about where we are with respect to the prophecy in chapter 7. Well, you see, we're after verse 25 in chapter 7. We're almost there, brothers and sisters. We're almost there. And we've got the privilege of looking back over all that has taken place before us and to be able to put it in perspective. And finally, in chapter 8 that we're looking at tonight, we're in verse 25. We're right at the end, brothers and sisters, of the period of prophecy that God has said will come to pass, and then shall the end be. Well, Daniel was about 72 years old when he received the vision of chapter 8. And you'll recall that in chapter 7, the dominant figure in chapter 7 was the little horn of the beast. And God wants us to understand a lot more about the end times than what could be revealed in that single symbol. That religious little horn that arose became the greatest dominion that mankind has ever seen. So tonight we're going to consider another little horn, and it's different to the little horn in chapter 7. Whereas the little horn in chapter 7 was a religious horn and it was in the West, tonight the little horn that we're going to consider in chapter 8 is a military horn and it's in the East. And the fact that God has called both of these powers little horns is deliberate. He wants us to make a connection between them. Why? Well, because at the time of the end, they're going to be confederate. As we saw in chapter 7, the little horn persecuted, we might say, spiritual Israel. What we're going to see in chapter 8 is that this horn of the East subjugates natural Israel. Now, Daniel's very careful to distinguish between natural Israel and spiritual Israel in these chapters. In chapter 7, spiritual Israel is referred to as the holy ones, whereas in chapter 8, the natural Israel is referred to as the people of the holy ones. You might like to note that in verse 24. We've got at the end of verse 24 the expression holy people, and you'll note in your margin it says people of the holy ones. It's talking about natural Israel. The same expression occurs in verse 27 of chapter 8. And as we mentioned last week, the role of the those who are accepted by Christ at the judgment, their work is going to be in chapter 7 in destroying that unholy religious power. They're titled the holy ones. Whereas in chapter 8, the work of the saints is captured in the expression, or they're captured in the title, Prince of Princes. That's going to be our role, brothers and sisters and young people, is to participate in that work that God has of bringing those two little horns to an end. Well, chapter 2 can perhaps be summarised this way. We've got in verses 1 to 12 the vision, and it's broken up quite simply this way: the ram's campaigns, the goat's campaigns, the goat's four horns, the little horn's exploits, and then we've got this next section, verses 13 to 19, the angelic ministrations to Daniel, where we're going to see there were actually four angels that were involved in ministering to Daniel. And finally, the last group of verses, 20 to 27, we could title Gabriel expands the vision to Daniel. Now, you notice I haven't said Gabriel interprets the vision to Daniel, because strictly speaking, verses 20 to 27 weren't actually so much an interpretation for Daniel, but rather an extrapolation, an expansion of what was shown in the vision. In the vision, what was revealed to Daniel was, if you like, the little horn in its Roman Empire manifestation. What's explained to Daniel by Gabriel is the little horn in its latter day manifestation, when it's also destroyed by Christ. So when Gabriel is directed to make Daniel understand the vision, he really skips over pretty much the ram and the goat and focuses on the little horn. So those first eight verses, you might say, are really only there to introduce this little horn that we're going to see tonight. Daniel saw in a vision two animals. He saw a ram and he saw a he-goat. And we're left in no doubt as to what those two are, because we're told in verses 20 and 21. The ram is the king of Persia, and the he-goat, the kings of Grecia. Now, it's interesting to note that in Neo-Persian times, that the princes actually wore a headdress which included ram's horns. Now, I do stress this is not in the Persian times that we're talking about in Daniel 2. It is a later period in history called the Neo-Persian times, from 200 to, well, the 3rd to the 7th century. But nevertheless, it's interesting to note that that was the way the Persian princes adorned themselves. And you might be able to just make out on that coin that the headdress, once again, includes ram's horns. So the Sasanian princes wore a headdress with ram's horns. Now, verse 4 tells us about the campaigns of the Persian horn. I saw a ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. Now, out of all of the campaigns of this ram, the one that's of significance to us is its western campaign, its push to the extremity of the empire in the west. It was during the reign of Xerxes in about 480 BC that Persia invaded Greece and torched Athens. And really, that was significant because it absolutely embittered the Grecians towards the Persians for centuries afterwards. And as we're going to see later, that was one of the motives of Alexander the Great when he went back into Persia and attacked them. As Daniel chapter 11 and verse 2 says, in speaking of Xerxes, by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. So he had the riches, he had the power to go into Greece, but it actually was his undoing. He went too far. And as we said, that really embittered the Grecians against him. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the conquest now of the goat, which of course is representative of the kings of Grecia. And it's perhaps worthwhile noting that from a a biblical point of view, the whole kingdom of Grisha occupies a period of the Bible which was a period of darkness. You see, following the prophet Malachi, God said that the sun would go down on the prophets. So there was a period of about 400 years where there was no open vision to Israel. There were no prophets. And it was during that period that the Grecian kingdom came and went. And if it wasn't for Daniel chapter 8, 11 and Zechariah 9, from a biblical point of view, we wouldn't know very much about that time period. Now, as we're told in verse 21, the rough goat that we're going to read about in verse 5 is the first king of Greece. But there was, before that, before Alexander came to the fore, there was some preparatory work that needed to be done. We're going to spend a little bit of time just looking at that preparatory work. Just before Alexander came to power in 336 BC, two significant things happened that paved the way for Alexander to be successful. And both of those things were the work of his father, Philip II of Macedon. He did, if you like, some groundwork for Alexander. Now, the first thing was important that Philip of Macedon did was this. He created what's called the Hellenic League. So what I want you to understand is this, that both Alexander and his father came from Macedonia. It was really, prior to this Hellenic League, it was just an entity by itself. But what Philip did, Alexander's father, was to unite Greece, Macedonia and Thrace. You can see them there in the same colour. And so that then made them a formidable force. But there was something else that Philip of Macedon did which really made a difference so far as the success of Alexander's campaigns. And that is this. He developed this arsenal which consisted of a 5.5 metre pike called a sarissa, and he trained his men, that's a pretty long weapon when you think about it, 5.5 metres, and he trained his men to use this like a machine. He put them in tight formation into what's known as a phalanx, and they kept rank. So you can imagine if you've got several thousand of these men facing you as an opposing force, it was quite formidable, and that really gave Alexander a significant advantage. So having developed those two things, Philip was set to go. He was set to take vengeance on Persia and to cross over into Asia Minor and to do to the Persians what they had done to him. But that wasn't God's plan. God had another signed out or assigned for that work. Philip was assassinated by his own bodyguard. And on that very day, Alexander's army hailed the 20-year-old son as their king. And in just 10 years, Alexander travelled 10,000 kilometres and conquered and achieved the greatest empire at the time that the world had ever seen. Now, there were three major campaigns that Alexander engaged in with the Persians. The first of those was at the Battle of Granicus. So just 2 years after coming to power, Alexander crossed the Hellespont, which is this area of Asia and Europe, if you like, the bridge between the two. Just 2 years after coming to power, he crosses over into Asia Minor. And in the words of verse 5, let's read that. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. So here is Alexander, represented by the goat, and he crosses over the Hellespont into Asia Minor. As we said, he fought three decisive battles with the Persians, at the end of which he cast down the ram and stamped it to the ground. Now, the first of those two battles were as he entered into Asia at a place called Granicus. That was actually at a river. And his 40,000 strong army delivered a crushing blow to the Persian army. Just 1 year later, having conquered Asia Minor, he was poised to enter into Syria here. And he was met by Darius himself. And Darius had strategically positioned himself so that he had sandwiched Alexander between the mountains and between the ocean, between the mountains and the ocean, on this narrow plain of about 10 kilometres wide. He thought that he had the day fixed. But you see, although Alexander was outnumbered 2-1, the battle once again was a stunning victory for Alexander. And Darius fled the battle and escaped. And in reading the account of that battle, one of the historians records the words of Ptolemy, who was one of Alexander's commander, and he had this to say. Ptolemy told Alexander that the number of dead Persians was so great that his men used their bodies to fill a deep ravine so that they could cross over it. And among the spoils of victory that Alexander got from the Persians was, surprisingly, Darius's wife, his mother, and his children. Apparently, Darius took them in the battle as a demonstration of his confidence that he was going to be victorious, but actually they were captured. And I'd like to share with you a letter that I find this quite interesting, you mightn't, but I find this interesting, the letter that Darius wrote to Alexander. Darius the king to Alexander. If you wish to fix a price for the redemption of my mother, wife and children, that I may redeem them. With reference to the empire, as to whom it shall belong, we will decide that in a general battle, with an equal number of soldiers on either side. But if you are capable of receiving counsel, I would advise you to return to Europe and be content with the kingdom of your ancestors and not to invade the territory of another. From henceforth, let us live as friends and faithful allies. I myself am ready to swear to the observance of these articles and to receive your oath. Well, how do you think Alexander responded to that? Well, this is how we responded. I'm not going to read it all out, but I'll show you this just to highlight the fact of what the motive was of Alexander. He said to Darius, "You've plundered our cities, Darius. You've laid waste to our plains. By the way, I know you're involved in the assassination of my father." He goes on to say, "By the way, Darius, I'm inclined to think that the gods are on my side and favour my arms." And I like the last line that Alexander puts in his letter. "But remember this, Darius, when you have occasion to write to me again, that you address not only a king, but your king." Well, as you can imagine, the proud Darius was not going to take heed to that letter. And so they were going to engage in battle just once more. And 2 years later, they met at Gaugamela, which, as you can see on the map, is east of Syria. And that was a decisive battle. Once again, it was an overwhelming victory to Alexander. In the words of Scripture, he ran into the Persian ram with the fury of his power, broke his two horns, and stamped him to the ground. You know, it's interesting to note that from Gaugamela, that Alexander continued down to Babylon, then across to Susa, which was the very place that 220 years earlier, the man Daniel had seen the vision concerning Alexander. So we're told in verse 8 about the he-goat waxing very great, which we've considered, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. Alexander went on to conquer as far east as the Indus. Then he returned to Babylon, where he died apparently from intoxication. Now, following the death of Alexander in 323 BC, His successors, known as the Diadochi, fought over control of his empire. And you know, I find it incredible, in a way, to think that the generals of Alexander, and there was at least six of them, for 20 years, for two decades, fought side by side in battle. They were brothers in arms. But as soon as Alexander died, they were the most bitter of enemies. And what does that tell us, brothers and sisters and young people, about the flesh? It tells us a lot, doesn't it? That these men were really only there for self-aggrandizement. And in fact, when you look at the Greek kingdom as a whole, it was quite a fractious kingdom. You know, halfway through Alexander's conquest, he has to send a general back to deal with the people who are his own people who are revolting in Greece. And throughout his journeys through Persia in conquering those territories across to the Indus, there were several times where he had to kill some of his closest friends in order that they didn't risk killing him. So these generals fought for two decades against each other, and in 301 BC, following the Battle of Ipsus, there was a finalisation, if you like, of who got what territory. And the victors were Cassander. He became ruler of Macedon. Lysimachus was ruler of Thrace. Seleucus became ruler of Babylon and Persia. And Ptolemy's ruler of Egypt in the south. So in the words of verse 8, when he was strong, that great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. So they are the successors, the four generals of Alexander that took control of the kingdom that was now divided. So this is what the empire looked like in 301 BC. Now I want you to pay particular attention to the area inside the square. At the time when that division occurred in 301 BC, the area of, the western end of Asia Minor, if you like, was occupied by Lysimachus. In verses 9 to 12, we're told about the exploits of this little horn. Out of one of the four horns came forth a little horn. So this is how we're going to deal with verses 9 to 12. We're going to briefly establish who the little horn is, look at how it came out of one of the four horns, and then we're going to come back to verses 9 to 12 and look at them in more detail. The reason I'm telling you this is we're going to deal with these verses just briefly, but I want you to know we're going to come back later on. Who or what was the little horn? Well, some have answered that question by saying it's the Antichrist. Others have said it's Antiochus Epiphanes. It can't be Antiochus Epiphanes because he occurred partway through the Seleucid Empire, whereas we're told here that this little horn would come toward the end of their rule. The other thing is that Antiochus Epiphanes didn't do what it says the little horn would do here in verse 11, and that is stand up against the prince of princes. But we are told three things about this little horn which leave us in no doubt as to who it was. Firstly, verse 11 says that he magnified himself against the prince of the host. That's speaking of none other than the Lord Jesus Christ. He was to put to death Christ. That's the first point. The second point is we're told that the little horn would cast down, note it says, the place of his sanctuary. Now the word sanctuary there is the Hebrew word mikdash, and it's referring to the temple. Now we need to read carefully here. It doesn't say he would cast down the sanctuary. It says the place of his sanctuary. Now that word place means fixture or basis. And in Psalm 104 verse 5, it's rendered foundations. In other words, the horn would destroy not only the temple, but its foundations. That's the second point. Thirdly, in verse 23, The horn is described as a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences. And those very same words are used where? Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verses 49 to 50. Where it's used to describe a power that would come from afar, as swift as the eagle, and it would place a yoke of iron on their head. So there can be no doubt when we put those three points together, it triangulates to the Roman Empire. And in alluding to verse 11, Christ said, "Seest thou these great buildings? There shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." He understood that when the place of the sanctuary was cast down, it was going to destroy both the foundations and the temple. And so incidentally, just to pause for a moment, it's worth noting that within this chapter, or let me rewind, if you were asked to prove what the metals in the image of chapter 2 were, how would you do it without a history book? Well, within the bounds of this chapter, you can identify three of them. We're told two of them in verses 20 and 21. And with those three points that we've just talked about, you can identify that the third one is Rome. And from Daniel chapter 2 and verse 40, we're told that the head of gold was Babylon. So that's a way of referencing, if you like, who those powers are. So clearly then, this little horn in chapter 8, this military little horn, cannot be the same as the little horn in chapter 7. Which came 600 years later in the 5th century. So if the little horn is, in its beginning, the Roman Empire, how did it come out of one of the four horns? Well, you see, in 281 BC, Lysimachus was killed and his dynasty ended. Now, at this time, there were two important things happened. Two significant things took place. Firstly, Antiochus I, who was one of the Seleucid kings, he extended his dominion right to the end of Asia Minor, and he incorporated all of that territory within his realm, territory that was previously held by Lysimachus. So all of that territory there became held by the Seleucid Empire, which you can see extends right across to the Indus. But there was something else that took place. And that was that a little territory of Pergamos remained independent and actually held the Seleucids at bay. So this is what the empire looked like in 192 BC. You'll note that Asia Minor is now part of this Seleucid Empire. Now, the rising power of Antiochus in Asia Minor was of concern to the Romans. And in 190 BC, the Romans attacked the Seleucid king Antiochus Antiochus III, in a battle at a place called Magnesia in Turkey, and the Seleucids lost a majority of their army. And so Antiochus III was forced to retreat, and he was forced to sign a peace treaty in 188 BC. And under the terms of that peace treaty, he was going to surrender all of the territory in Asia Minor. That was the part of the peace treaty that he signed with the Romans. Now, the intriguing twist to this is that in this battle between Antiochus III and Rome, that this little independent territory of Pergamos joined with the Romans against Antiochus. At the end of the war, as a in reward, if you like, for their support, Pergamos was given all of this territory here. So this is what the map looks like in 188 BC. 57 years later, in 133 BC, a momentous event occurred. Attalus III, who was one of the kings of Pergamos, he died, and he bequeathed that entire area to the Romans, to the Rome. And we might say That territory then became the Roman Little Horn. That event is described in verse 9 as one of the little horns coming out, and out of one of them came forth a little horn. Now it's important to note this. The little horn came out of the Seleucid horn, but when that little horn came out of the Seleucid horn, it took part, but not all, of the Seleucid dominion. Remember, the Seleucid dominion extended way over here, right into Afghanistan, Iraq, etc. So the little horn took part, but not all, of the Seleucid dominion. Had he taken it all of that, if he had taken all of that dominion, it couldn't be said that the horn, the little horn, came out of the horn, but rather that it plucked up the horn, or at least it replaced it. The Seleucid horn lasted another 123 years until 65 BC. But there's an interesting point here. When Rome inherited this territory here that was bequeathed to it, it got not only territory, but it also inherited religion. And the reason is because just before Babylon fell, the priests in Babylon fled to where? They fled to Pergamos. And so what happened was that that Babylonian religion, in fact, became perpetuated by the Romans. So the Romans, that little horn that came out of that territory, absorbed not only the previous Seleucid power, but also the religion that went with that as well. And so we're told that the little horn in verse 9 waxed exceeding great. It was bequeathed Asia Minor in 133 BC. In BC 65, Syria fell. And in BC 30, Egypt fell. And so over a period of 600 years, that's a considerable period of time, the little men of the Italian peninsula established a dominion that had never been seen before. The little horn truly waxed great. So what we want to do now is, as we've said, we've covered that, the development of the little horn. We've seen how it came out of one of the horns. We want to go back now and just spend a little bit more time looking at verses 9 to 12. Now, we're told that there were six things that were cast down by the little horn, that is, the Romans. The host, the stars, the prince of the host, the daily, the sanctuary, and the truth. And those six things we can perhaps summarise this way. The people, their prince, and the nation's worship. And those three things were cast down at different times. Christ was cast down in AD 33, the people in AD 70, and in AD 132. When Daniel read this, imagine how he felt. He knew what this meant for his people. He knew that they were yet again going to be cast down. But when he read that the prince of the host was also going to be cast down, the effect of that, brothers and sisters and young people, is told to us in verse 27. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterwards I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood. The first thing that was cast down, we're told, is the host of heaven. It's referring to Israel. How do we know that? When Joshua asked the angel at Gilgal, whose side are you on? The angel replied this way, nay, but for the prince of the host of Yahweh am I now come. So why should natural Israel be referred to as the host of heaven? Well, simply because of their inalienable relationship with God. What a sad state of affairs that natural Israel, who are described as the host of heaven, should fall from it. You know, the Jews really lightly esteemed the position that God had called them to. And what of us, brothers and sisters and young people? Think about the privileged position that we have. Are we really appreciative of that position? The Jews had codified their religion so that righteousness was measurable and quantifiable, yet they overlooked the weightier matters of the law: judgment, mercy, and faith. You know, talking about the casting down of the host of heaven, Josephus writes about this casting down, and he records this. He says that Titus, who was the Roman general who was sent to deal with the Jews in AD 70, it says that he began the siege of Jerusalem just a few days before Passover. Why? To make sure that the number of people inside the city of Jerusalem was at its peak, so that when they besieged the city, they were going to starve more quickly with so many people inside. Josephus estimates that there was about 1.1 million people who were in the city and who died from that siege. And when the Romans entered the city, they showed mercy to nobody. Josephus says the armed rebels, as well as the frail citizens, were put to death. The stars, the leaders of the nation, were cast down as well. They also cast down the prince of the host, as we've already considered, that's Christ. But you know, I think this is the first time in the Bible when the time in which the prince of the host would appear is told to us. Sure, there are places where in the Psalms we're told there would be a prince come, but I think this is the very first time in the Bible where we're told the era in which the Messiah would come. You know, we're told that power would be given, or that the host would be given over to the little horn in verse 12. And so it was with Christ. Rome was given power by God. It was not of themselves. That was true of the nation. It was true of the Messiah. And so Christ said to Pilate, "Thou couldest have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above." We're told in verse 11 that the daily was taken away. It's referring here to the daily sacrifice. In other words, the burnt offering. It's true to say that, yes, when Christ was killed, that the Mosaic code came to an end, and in that sense the daily ended. But in actual fact, the Jews continued to offer for many years until the taking away of the temple. Verse 11, we've already talked about the sanctuary. It is referring to the temple. But a fine point to note is that it refers to it as his sanctuary. In other words, Christ's sanctuary. This was the place of his Father's house. And finally, we're told in verse 12 that the truth would be cast down to the ground. And following the death of Christ, what we find is that pagan Rome treated those loyal to Christ as enemies of the state. You know, all of those six things that were cast down were cast down for the same reason, for the nation's transgressions. In verse 23, Gabriel says, "These things would be done when the transgressors are come to the full." What that means is that Christ's sacrifice for their transgressions was made at the very zenith of the nation's sins. And as Christ said in Matthew 23, "Fill ye up the measure of your fathers." So that brings us to the next section of the prophecy, the angelic ministrations. And I'm conscious of the time, so I'm going to deal with this fairly briefly. But suffice to say that as we read in Hebrews chapter 1, Paul says, "Are not the angels ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation?" And perhaps there could be no better illustration of that, brothers and sisters, than what we have before us. We have four angels ministering to Daniel. Two angels appeared, one of whom we're told was Palmoni when we read the margin. He's the wonderful numberer. He's the one that sequences out, if you like, all of the divine events to make sure that they occur at the right time. One of them asks a question, "How long should be the vision?" And the other answers, not to the angel, but to Daniel, 2,300 days. Another angel then appears before Daniel as he seeks to know the answer to these things, the angel Gabriel. And then Gabriel is directed from yet another angel, who we suspect is Michael, who says to Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. Now, the reason why we'd suggest that the unnamed angel is Michael is simply because he directs Gabriel in this episode. So, the question is asked about the period of the vision, the 2,300 years. In view of the time, we're just going to make a couple of statements, brothers and sisters, but basically the answer given is relating to not only the duration, but the end point of the vision. We're told that the duration would be 2,300 evening mornings or 2,300 years. And at the end of that period, there would be an end of the downtreading of Jerusalem. Now, we know the daily was suppressed in the time of Daniel. It was subsequently suppressed in the time of in AD 70 for a period of 2,000 years. But that changed in 1967 when the Jordanians lost control of Jerusalem. So we have to ask the question then, was there an event 2,300 years before 1967? And yes, there is. It was the Battle of Granicus. So we must ask the question then, what relevance does the Battle of Granicus have to the incipient fulfilment of this prophecy in 1967? And I think the answer is this, that under Persian rule, the Jews were not trodden down. But that changed when Grecian rule began. And that was marked, if you like, by the first victory of Alexander over the Persians at Granicus. That's the best suggestion I can think of, brothers and sisters. If you've got another thought, I'd be happy to hear it. What we do know is this, that in the ultimate fulfilment of this period, the sanctuary will no longer be trodden underfoot. And so I think what we have to see is that 1967 was merely an incipient fulfilment of that. As Brother Thomas says, when these years have elapsed, neither Turk, Frank, nor Russian, Greek nor Latin will be permitted to desecrate the holy with their hateful presence and abominations. We're going to now look at verses 24 and 25. We've now come to the explanation of the vision that Gabriel gave to Daniel. We've already looked at verses 20 to 23. As previously mentioned, Gabriel extrapolated on what Daniel saw in the vision. And in verse 19, we actually read that. Gabriel says, I'll make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. And so we read in verse 24, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. That verse can be summarized in this way. Rome was a tool in God's strong hand. Hence the reason for their stunning success in battle. It was not by their own power. And as Deuteronomy said, Yahweh shall bring a nation against thee from far. And the destruction of that mighty people was accomplished, as we said, in AD 70. Now, it's evident from verse 25 that the little horn would yet stand up once more, but this time against the Prince of Princes, as distinct from the Prince of the Host in verse 11. So the Prince of Princes in verse 25 is talking about Christ and the saints. Now, it's apparent that at no time has the Roman Empire ever stood up against Christ and the saints. And it may seem strange that, you know, within the space of one verse, we've got the little horn in verse 24 referring to Rome and the little horn in verse 25 referring to another power. But really that's consistent, brothers and sisters and young people, with the pattern that we've seen in Daniel. You remember in chapter 2 that what Daniel really wanted to do was to give us enough historical narrative so that we could recognise the approach of the time of the end. He did the same in chapter 7, gave us the historical narrative, then jumps to the end and tells us about the little horn of the beast in the latter days. He's doing the same thing here. Different little horn. He's setting the historical context so that we can recognise when he jumps to the time of the end 2,000 years later, we can recognise the hallmarks of the little horn. So that poses the question, what is or what are the hallmarks of the little horn of the goat that will enable us to identify that horn at the time of the end? And I think this quote from Elpis Israel is really helpful. Brother Thomas says this, "The little horns are representative of powers on certain territories, not of races. It matters not whether they are pagan Romans, Catholic Greeks, Muslim Turks, or Greek Catholic Russians." And note this is important. This is the hallmark of the little horn of the little goat in chapter 8. The power that rules in Constantinople and plants its standard in Assyria is the little horn. And by standard, he means basically military standard or presence. So where does he get Constantinople from? How can he make that or draw that conclusion? Well, clearly he's not getting that just from within chapter 8. He's pulling together a collage of prophecies and he's saying, I know that at the time of the end, the little horn will occupy Constantinople. That's going to be one of its hallmarks. And not only that, I know from this chapter that it's going to be in control of Assyria, which was the horn that the little horn came out of. We believe that Russia will be the latter-day manifestation of that little horn in verse 25. Why do we say that? Simply because in the latter days we know that Russia is the power that will take Constantinople and then come down into the Middle East. It's the power of Ezekiel 38, isn't it? It's the power that will invade Israel and be conquered by Christ. So the latter-day little horn will fit the mould of its Roman predecessor. That's the point I'd like you to understand. We've got a pattern, and now we're being shown how that pattern will be applied in a latter-day application. The latter-day little horn will fit the mould of its Roman predecessor. That is, he will rule in Constantinople and will be confederate with a pope in Rome. That was the situation in the Roman Empire from 476 to 800 AD, when you had in the west, the Pope had dominion over the 10 horn kingdoms, and in the east, the Roman Emperor ruled in Constantinople. And if you want to know what a type or a template looks like of what Russia will do in the latter days, it's to be seen in the rule of the reign of Emperor Justinian. Emperor Justinian reigned from 527 to 565 AD, and he provides a classic example of the mould. Let me explain what I mean. Verse 25 reveals the strategy that Russia, as the little horn, will employ before he stands up as the prince of princes. He's going to have two things in his strategy, and both of them involve falsehood. Firstly, he causes craft to prosper, and by peace he shall destroy many. Brother Thomas renders that expression, cause craft to prosper, as cause falsehood to prosper. And we can understand what that means by looking at Emperor Justinian. Emperor Justinian's policy was what we might call ecclesiastical, and that is he was very much involved in the church. This is what a couple of historians say about the rule of Emperor Justinian. So we're looking at this because it sets the pattern of what we expect to see in the latter days of the little horn when it re-emerges. Never prince did meddle so much with what concerns the affairs of the church, nor did he make so many constitutions and laws upon the subject, says Dupin. Gibbon says, Justinian sympathised with his subjects in their superstitious reverence for living and departed saints. Note that he paid respect, if you like, to this idea of, you know, as the Catholic Church does, of having these saints. And in the case of Justinian, he thought that Michael was his patron saint. And they have all these pigeonholes and there's a saint in each one. And depending on what day of the week it is, you pull one out of the pigeonhole and that's the saint for today. That's the sort of thing that Justinian believed in. Well, have a look at this. That's the pattern. Here's the latter-day application. He shall cause falsehood to prosper. This is an article taken from 2017. It says, the Soviet Union turned its back on religion, but modern Russia under Vladimir Putin, the former KGB officer, has made religion, nationalism, patriotism and conservatism cornerstones, and we might replace that with the word policy, of the Russian state. So he's doing exactly what we'd expect him to do, brothers and sisters and young people. He's following the pattern of Justinian, of the emperor that was in Constantinople that made craft or falsehood to prosper. The second attribute that we can expect of Russia is this, that as the little horn in the latter days, he will, by peace, destroy many. In other words, he will not only promote falsehood, but he will promote a false sense of security. In fact, Rotherham renders that expression peace. Where does it occur? In verse 25. He renders that as careless security. I'd like you to turn with me quickly to Jeremiah chapter 49 and verse 31. Jeremiah chapter 49 and verse 31. Arise, get you up unto the wealthy nation that dwelleth without care. So, it's speaking of Judah here in the time of the Babylonian dominion. Arise, get you up unto the wealthy nation that dwelleth without care, saith Yahweh, which have neither gates nor bars, which dwell alone. That word without care, well, first of all, what is that an echo of? Where have you read words similar to that? It's in Ezekiel 38, isn't it? Very similar words. And in fact, the word that's rendered here without care is exactly the same word that's rendered safely in Ezekiel 38 and verse 11. So how was it? At the time when this was written in Jeremiah's day, Babylon was hovering as a power above Israel. But they didn't recognise them as a threat. They dwelt without care. And it will be exactly the same sort of situation that causes Israel to fall in the latter days. So Russia will follow the fate of Greece and Rome that have gone before. So let's just take a step back, brothers and sisters and young people, and put this together. We've considered two horns over the last 2 weeks. We've considered the little horn in Rome, and we said its hallmark was an allied dominion exercised by Rome and Constantinople. And the little horn in the east, the military horn, is the power that rules in Constantinople and plants its standard in Assyria. So at the time of the end, the dominion exercising power in the east will be both king of the north and the little horn. And at that time, the king of the north, which is a term that applies to Daniel chapter 11, I know, then the king of the north and the little horn will be manifested in one power. By way of closing, I want us to pause and think, brothers and sisters, about what we said at the beginning about where we stand with respect to prophecy. You know, Daniel received all these visions, but he only lived long enough to see the transition from the lion to the bear phase. The apostles were able to look back at the Grecian kingdom and to see the transition from the bear to the leopard phase, and to begin to see the emergence of the little horn in the east. For us, we've seen the bear phase come and go. We've seen the leopard phase come and go. We've seen the Roman Empire come and go. We've seen the 10-toed kingdoms form in Europe, established on the territory of the old Western Empire. The little horn of chapter 7 has emerged, plucked up three horns and persecuted the saints for a period of 1260 years. We've seen the little horn of Daniel chapter 7 morph from being a potentate in the period of the Holy Roman Empire to being a whore, as predicted in Revelation 17. We've now seen Russia in Syria, ready to become the king of the north. How blessed we are, brothers and sisters and young people, to perceive these things. Christ is coming to gather his saints to accomplish the work that we've read about tonight, to bring to an end the kingdom of men. There's nothing else left that has to be fulfilled before Christ can come and do that. And as we did at the beginning, in looking at where we stand with respect to all of these prophecies, we're right on the end. There's nothing else to be accomplished before Christ comes. And finally, think of this, brothers and sisters and young people. We've read in chapter 8 about one of the greatest conquerors of all time, Alexander the Great. You know, he's up there with only a couple of others that we might think of Napoleon. And at times in our life, we might think that we're insignificant and that we never really achieve anything. And you know, when you think about what took place in chapter 8, to me that's really quite touching. To Daniel it was revealed the exploits of that great man, Alexander the Great, from a military point of view. But after that, four angels came and ministered to Daniel. God is more interested in him that is of a meek and contrite spirit than he is of men like Alexander. Alexander's gone, forgotten. We have a wonderful hope, brothers and sisters. Might it be that we might be as Daniel was, a man who was of a poor and contrite spirit and who trembled at God's word.